Hello, and welcome to the Strange Horizons podcast. I'm Susan Grappi, the editor-in-chief of Strange Horizons. I'm also the host for the podcast. In this episode of the podcast, it's my pleasure to present an interview with Tim Pratt. Tim is an old friend of Strange Horizons. We've published a lot of his fiction and his poetry. Most recently, the story Artifice and Intelligence, which appeared in our magazine in early August. I interviewed Tim in late October 2007, in the middle of an extremely busy and exciting period in his life, both personally and professionally. Tim's story, Impossible Dreams, which was published in Asimov's last year, recently won the Hugo Award for Best Short Story, which was a phenomenally exciting thrill for everyone who knows Tim and likes his writing. Following closely on the heels of the Hugo win, Tim's novel Blood Engines, the first in a series about sorcerer Marla Mason, was recently released from Bantam Spectra, under the name T.A. Pratt rather than Tim Pratt, which we talk about a little bit in the interview. And as if all that weren't enough, Tim's about to be a father. He and his wife, Heather Shaw, are expecting their first child any day now. And I will see what I can do about getting a baby picture up on the podcast page as soon as one is available. So, without any further intro or fanfare, I now present the Strange Horizons podcast interview with author and Hugo Award winner Tim Pratt. So, hi, how's it going?
Hi, it's great to be here.
Okay, glad to have you on the Strange Horizons podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we should get right into the questions that I have for you.
All right.
The first one, we have two, there are two big pieces of news about you these days, and we will start with the first one, which is you are now Tim Pratt Hugo winning author.
That's true. Yes. No one was more surprised than I was.
And I'm sure you've told this a bunch of times, but if the podcast listeners haven't heard it, do you want to tell us again about how you found out that you won a Hugo?
The tale of my Hugo win. Yeah, well, I was so certain that I would not win that I didn't find out until quite late, because of course I was up against various esteemed people. But the sort of huge guy I was up against was Neil Gaiman, who has won, I think, the last three times that he's been nominated. So pretty much it was a foregone conclusion that Neil was going to walk away with it. And it's his story that was on the ballot. It's a great story. It's one of my favorites of his. So I wasn't even going to feel bad about losing to him. And then I figured it would be Ben. And then I thought maybe me. I thought maybe I'd get a gentleman's third in the rankings. So the ceremony was held in Japan. And I think it was set to start something like 1 a.m. local time. I'm in Oakland, California. So I actually didn't even stay up to see who won. I was sort of sitting around watching TV that night, and I thought, I could stay up till 2 a.m. and find out, you know, how bad I got beat. Meh, I'll just go to bed. So I went to sleep and slept quite peacefully until I had to pee or a cat jumped on me or something quotidian like that. So I got up, and after dealing with cat scratches or urination or whatever it was that woke me up, I decided, let me just log on. Let me get on the internet and see who won. I guess it was about 5 in the morning at that point. So I turned on my computer, and my email began downloading. And the first thing I saw was a message from John Scalzi that was just a single word. It said, congratulations. To which I thought, congratulations for what?
Congratulations on a close second place.
That's right. You know, congratulations for only losing a little bit. But no, indeed, several emails began pouring in, most of them equally unforthcoming in terms of real information. So I went to Locus Online or someplace, and lo and behold, there was the result. I had somehow fucking won a Hugo. It's, I was staggered, you know. I guess it's good that nobody called me. It would have been kind of cool to get a phone call at 2 in the morning, but it would have annoyed my then 7 months pregnant wife, I imagine, to have a phone call. Right. Although then at, you know, 5:30 in the morning, I promptly went in the bedroom and jumped on the bed and said, Heather, I won a Hugo! To which she replied, well, of course you won. I knew you were going to win a Hugo. Because in our relationship, we have this division of labor whereby she's the optimist who thinks good things will happen, and I just always assume that failure is what will happen. That way I'm always pleasantly surprised.
Well, I was saying I know Heather had been saying that she was so sure that you were going to win that she was planning on getting up in the middle of the night to check the results and then let you know that you had won, but instead she slept and you beat her to it.
That's right, I beat her to it, all because of a cat or having to pee, I forget which. Eventually I'll decide which is a better story and just stick with that. My wife just yelled cat from the next room. So, I sent an acceptance speech with my friend Paul Melko, who was also up for an award. He had a great story on the ballot in a different category, thank God. And, you know, it was kind of a crappy acceptance speech because I really thought nobody would read it but Paul. I almost just wrote dirty jokes to make Paul laugh. honestly, because I really thought I just had no shot at all. Right. And in fact, all of the sort of blog postings and news stories and bits about it sort of had that amazing, oh my god, the huge surprise from this, the upset, the underdog. I felt like I was in the, you know, the Bad News Bears or something. And somehow I'd pulled out and I'd beat the guys from the high school with the really high property values and right. the nice uniforms.
And you're the spunky kid from the wrong side of the tracks.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Lovable misfit.
I've seen the pictures from the... from that night, and Paul was in a very, very nice tuxedo. A very nice
yeah.
outfit.
You know, Paul cleans up good. He really does. And he got a lot of mileage out of my Hugo. He said every time he went in a room, people would stand up and burst into applause, and they would sing the You Won a Hugo song to the tune of Happy Birthday, apparently, which I have to get him to sing it for me next time I see him.
That's excellent.
I have a little trouble imagining how it goes, but yeah, I was bummed that I couldn't be there, but I couldn't go without my wife. She would have never forgiven me, and she was, at the time, 7 months pregnant. Indeed, at this point, we're a week away from her due date, so...
Right. That's actually... I had that on the list for later on in the interview, but we can talk about it now, actually. You are about
sure.
to be a dad.
I'm about to be a dad. First-time dad. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Are you excited?
Well, you know, I turned 30, you know, I don't know, 10.5 months ago, and when you get in your 30s, you're supposed to become a grown-up, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, so I figured it seemed like a good time. Heather thought it was a good time, so started trying, and worked out pretty well. So, yeah, we're literally only a week away from the due date, although she's a first-time mom. Maybe it'll be a little later. We're actually kind of hoping it'll be a little later so we can get our shit more together. But, you know, if the baby came tomorrow, we would be okay. We would be set.
Well, I was telling Heather some advice that I've seen given to anxious about-to-be new parents, specifically about the state of your house. You get a lot of people who are very worried, like, I can't have the baby yet. We don't have the crib set up, that kind of thing. And the advice that I've seen given is, you know what? Babies slept in dresser drawers for a very long time.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So the baby doesn't know if you don't have, you know, the changing table exactly where you want it and so on.
Well, you know, even a couple weeks ago, we had sort of thought, you know, sometimes babies are born early. If the baby was born right now, it would be fine. You know, the house is a disaster. We don't have any soup in the freezer, you know, whatever. But we'll survive. We'll manage. And fortunately, we've gotten, you know, this weekend, we sort of figure is maybe our last weekend. So it's been pretty evenly divided between let's do grown-up things, non-baby things. We went to a movie. We went out to dinner a couple of, you know, went out for breakfast today, slept in today. Well, Heather did. I was up at 8:30 again because I was thinking about all the stuff I had to do. But yeah, and the other half was, you know, beating rugs and boxing up stuff and making room in the house, and you know, things are coming along. I think we're prepared as much as anybody. Yeah, and 1,000 parents are laughing, but as far as anyone can be prepared,
right? You can't prepare for the things that are out of your hands,
but... exactly.
Right.
But by God, we've got washed baby clothes and we got a car seat installed and all that stuff, so
you're ready.
Yeah, ready enough.
Are we now going to see a flood of Tim Pratt stories about crazy babies?
I'm sure baby stuff will come in. Everything that ever happens in my life percolates into the fiction eventually, although usually it takes a couple years, so who knows? It might take me a little while to get my head around the whole fatherhood thing. Mm-hmm. But I might stop using Threaten a Child as a cheap device for creating sympathy and suspense in short stories if I have a kid of my own. I hear that happened, that you can no longer handle those Kid in Jeopardy movies and stories, that it just hits you too close to home.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was, well, that's good. Impressed.
Well, I'm gonna... father. Well, yeah, I mean, I have to stop writing stories about 20-something slackers and start writing stories about 30-something new parents, right? It's, the division between life and fiction is not always all that wide for me.
Mm. Do you think you do write a lot of stories about people who are more or less like you?
Oh God, always, yeah. I mean, I always set stories where I live. When I lived in North Carolina, I wrote all these rural fantasies. They're like urban fantasies, only there are cows instead of tall buildings. And when I moved out to California, I immediately started writing things in California. I lived in Santa Cruz for exactly 1 year and wrote a whole novel set in Santa Cruz. And, you know, I've been writing stuff set in Oakland and San Francisco. At this point, I'm writing stuff set in an imaginary city, but it certainly owes a lot to Oakland and San Francisco, so...
Well, actually, the next major, you know, Tim Pratt writing news on my list is the release of the Marla Mason books. And the first one is actually set in San Francisco, even though that is the non-San Francisco city you were talking about, is the core of the Marla books.
Yeah, it was perhaps not the most commercially intelligent move on my part to start a series set in a different city from the city where all the other books in the series are set. But hey, you know, you go where the story takes you. Having it set in a different city allows me to do some sort of fish-out-of-water stuff that's kind of fun, so...
What's your, at this point, I'm sure you have the, you know, three-sentence summary of Marla Mason and Blood Engines, but how would you give it to us?
Man, you'd totally think I would.
well, then so, feel free to describe Marla at greater
length. Feel free to blather. So Marla Mason is a sorcerer. She's chief sorcerer of a city on the East Coast called Fellport that's kind of a rusting city. It's a small city. It's Houston. It's Cleveland. You know, it's not a huge city, but it's big enough that you know it would probably have a little dot on the map of whatever imaginary state it's in. So she has this city that has seen better days. You know, maybe it had an industrial base in the 70s or whatever, but now it's kind of on hard times. But she runs it. It's her city, by God, and she loves every dirty, filthy alley of it. So her position is sort of a cross between a mob boss and a superhero. So she protects the city from supernatural threats. You know, if great old ones were to rise from the deep of the bay, she would be the one to fight them off. If interdimensional hedonistic demons come spewing out of sinkholes in the park, she would be the one to fight them back. In exchange for this, she does shady real estate deals and runs illegal gambling parlors and some smuggling and things of that nature. So you get kind of the magical underworld mixed in with a bit of the criminal underworld, which is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So she, in terms of character, Marla... Well, let's just say she doesn't have a problem with self-esteem. She's always absolutely positive that she's right, which makes for great stories when she is, in fact, totally dead wrong. It takes her a little while to sometimes bend her will to reality. She's also really fun to write because she's prone to violence, which is always nice in a fictional character, if you want sort of an action-oriented story. Somebody whose initial reaction to any problem is to kick it can make things fun. She's very pragmatic, very point A to point B, very blunt. One reviewer described her as the bitchiest superheroine ever, which I appreciated. So the plot of Blood Engines is her city is being threatened. She is being threatened. She has a rival, another sorcerer, who thinks that this uncouth upstart, she's very young to be a chief sorcerer, through complicated blah blah backstory, she does crap and winds up in this position of power and holds onto it tooth and nail. But anyway, she has rivals who don't think she deserves the gig. One of them is going to cast a big nasty spell without going into details because I don't reveal the nature of the spell until late in the book. Big nasty thing. She has to stop it. In order to stop it, she needs this artifact, this thing called the Cornerstone, which unfortunately happens to be in San Francisco. You know, it's a MacGuffin. It's this thing that she has to get. And kind of what it does is augment and intensify and sort of anchor magical spells. So if she can get this thing, she can do her own big magic and stop her rival from fucking things up. So she comes to San Francisco, where she's got a friend who knows where to find the thing. It's going to be great. She thinks she's going to fly in, fly out. It'll take 2 days. She gets here. Her contact has been murdered. Then she discovers that various other sorcerers in San Francisco are being murdered. And before long, she is completely embroiled in local politics. Some people think she's offing the other sorcerers. The guy who's killing the other sorcerers wants the same artifact that she wants, so she's in direct opposition. She basically finds herself in the uncomfortable position of having to save San Francisco, a city that she frankly kind of despises. Because, come on, there's not even a proper winter there, you know? You don't even get snow. It's weird. And she's along with her sidekick, Rondo, who's kind of the opposite of her. He's hedonistic, and he has a really short attention span. He's easily distracted, but he's fiercely loyal. He's good with a butterfly knife. He knows how to break and enter. You know, he always has her back unless something shiny distracts him. He does your sort of classic sidekick action. So it's a lot of fun to write their dynamic, their characters. So in a way, they're sort of, you know, the odd couple on vacation in San Francisco with murderous poison frogs and Aztec gods and things of that nature.
Great.
not three sentences.
You know, it's a good description. One thing that I do find interesting about Marla, as a reader, one thing I find interesting about Marla is how she seems most comfortable when everything is sort of broken or dirty or going all to hell.
Sure.
When smoothly run operations seem to make her very, very nervous. And that seems to be, there's a sense of kind of grittiness in the books that's a lot of fun. But
you know, she's very comfortable with chaos. Her background, which, you know, it's like book three before I even really talk much about how she grew up or anything, and a lot more of that will come up in book four, which I will start writing once, I guess, I have a BB that sleeps through the night or something. Have to start writing it pretty soon. But, you know, she ran away from home when she had a bad home life. She ran away when she was like 14. She came to the city. She lived on the street. She had shitty jobs. She ran with a bad crowd. She slept in alleys. She ate out of dumpsters. That's kind of what she's comfortable with when she has to, you know, put on an evening gown and go to a high society function, and she occasionally has to do stuff like that in her job. She's really not comfortable. And when she gets antsy, she's the kind of person who always wants to be doing something. If there's a problem and she's trying to fix it, she's happy because she doesn't have time to brood or worry or think about everything that's not being done or that doesn't work the way she wants it to. She's the kind of, you know, they're those people who, when they don't have a project, they just pace back and forth like a lion in a cage, and she's one of those people.
Blood Engines is the first Marla Mason novel, and there are three more coming out in the next year and a half to 2 years.
Oh, God, yes.
But you've been writing about Marla for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could sort of talk a little about Marla's history as a character. I mean, where did you start with her? Where does she come from for you? And when did you realize that this was a character who you were getting more than just a short story or two out of?
Well, sure. I've been writing about her for at least 10 years. The earliest stories I remember writing when I was in college working in this crappy antique store. And I had a lot of free time because in the winter there were no tourists. Nobody would come into the antique store, so I would sit there and write stories. Some of the ones I wrote were about Marla. She was originally inspired very much by horror sort of heroines. I remember Nancy Collins, her Sonya Blue series, which are sort of these gritty ass-kicking vampire novels. I can't remember, the names of them escape me, but it's a character who appeared in a lot of her stories and a couple novels. And I, you know, kind of started life as a horror writer, so the first stories about Marla were really brutal and really gritty and had no humor, nothing funny in them at all. You know, the first one, which was finally published just a couple years ago in a short-lived online magazine, was a story called Heru Specs, where Marla has to go up against this serial killer who's, you know, well, there's no nice way to say it, he's gutting people and reading their entrails to find out the future. So not a happy, fun story, kind of a gross story, but it did introduce certain fundamental elements of the character, like her pragmatism, her badassery. She has this magical cloak, which has, you know, it's really too powerful. And originally it was just this awesome, powerful thing that allowed her to kick ass. And for the first novel, it was such a powerful piece of magic that I had to give it some pretty brutal drawbacks. Basically, using it can turn her into an unstoppable killing machine, and it can also heal her of just about any injury short of absolute death. The drawback that I gave it is that it's possessed of this sort of alien parasitic intelligence that kind of attempts to take over her mind every time she wears it, and it sort of builds up in her body like mercury. It gets a little worse every time she uses it and lasts a little longer, and really one of these days, if she uses it one too many times, she's going to completely lose her mind and just be a monster wearing her body. So, you know, I gave it some drawbacks, but so I introduced kind of those fundamental things about her character early on, and I wrote a few stories that very much had that dark horror, you know, lots of blood, lots of guts kind of tone, and something was missing about them. I finally decided I did like the character enough to try and write a book about her. Probably, I want to say it was in 2000 or 2001, and so I tried to write a book called Ferocious Dreamers. That was about a plague of nightmares coming to her city, and it was a really dark, kind of horrific book. And I was in sort of a dark place while working on it, and I got about 50,000 words into it, and it just completely went off the rails. Just, you know, it was just riddled with plot problems and character problems, and I also just didn't enjoy doing it. So I put her aside for a while, and then I got this idea to make her come to San Francisco after I moved out here. I thought it'd be fun to take that character and drop her into this other setting. And when I started writing her again, I wrote a story called Pale Dog that was in my first collection, and I started writing Blood Engines. For the first time, this humor came into it. I had somehow, in the few years in between, changed enough as a writer that I wanted there to be this funniness and this lightness of tone. And so there's a whole lot of banter between her and Rondo, which never existed in those early stories. And the blood and the guts, you know, there's still a lot of violence. In Blood Engines, people get their hearts ripped out and things like that. And, you know, people choke to death on poisonous frogs and things of that nature. So it's not like it's all happy la-la, but, you know, there's a lot of snark and sarcasm and funniness. And I like to think wittiness and cleverness.
I would say definitely.
Oh, thanks. And, you know, I sort of thought that this was a character and that she had kind of a rich enough cast of secondary characters that I could write an open-ended series. You know, I want every book to stand alone. I do have in mind some sort of overarching character stuff. Like, over the course of the books, I kind of see her as her evolution from thug to statesman. You know, eventually she's going to have to realize that she can trust people, that diplomacy might occasionally be the better path rather than just kicking her enemies, that she can't solve every problem just by punching it, you know, things like that. So I'm working some of that stuff in, but every book has kind of its own standalone plot. And I get to put her through a lot of nasty stuff. Actually, that book, Ferocious Dreamers, for the second novel in the series, after I sold a sequel, I had to write a sequel, and the one that I pitched was that plot from that book, Ferocious Dreamers, where this plague of nightmares comes to our city. So I thought, this is going to be easy. There's like 50,000 words of this book. And, you know, but sure, it went off the rails. I'll have to trim the last 10,000 or something, but still, it's half a book. I'll get to it. And so I wasted, you know, a couple months trying to make that work before I just scrapped it completely and did a page one rewrite. And kept kind of the central idea, but really that was it. You know, I kept sort of the antagonist and everything else about it changed, and it's a much better book for it. I don't think a single line remains from that original draft.
I like how you brought up that for Marla, the magic has consequences. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's a nice balance, because I know that sometimes people will use fantasy or magic in stories in a way where it seems, it's make things too easy. I know I've read some romance novels, it's my shameful confession, my romance novel thing, but some romance novels that incorporate magic or fantasy elements, which is and I don't mean paranormal romance, I mean these are straight category romance that right. happen to include magic, and the magic is always very easy. You know, people can do ridiculous things and there's never any downside. But then the other side of that is I know people in the sort of genre fantasy and science fiction community talk about how sometimes the way people write magical systems, it's basically like science, except that the outcome is different. And at that point,
yeah,
that's also in its own way not as much fun.
Yeah, well, very much I'm aware of that tendency to try and want to write magic that is a secret science, or that's run like something in a role-playing game where you get, or, you know, like a massively multiplayer online role-playing game where you get a certain number of mana points and you can use it to cast a certain number of spells or whatever. And to me, that does suck out some of the deep weirdness and mystery in the books. So my magical underpinning for the world of the Marla Mason novels is that every kind of magic works. Kabbalah works, voodoo works, sympathetic magic works, contagious magic works. All of it works if you can do it right. But it's really, really difficult to do it right. There are some things that you can learn to do. You know, there are some spells that just about anybody with the right training could probably pull off, and there are some things that you have to have some inherent ability to do. And I'm not talking about some sort of Harry Potter, it's magic in your blood thing. I'm talking about, you know, there are some people who have perfect pitch and some people who don't. There are some people who, no matter how hard they practice, will never be world-class NBA basketball stars. In fact, most of us. We could play ball all day long and we would never be as good as those people who, through a combination of inborn skill and intense practice, managed to be world-class. You know, mm-hmm. So there are some people who just have that quirk, or they have, you know, whatever the magical equivalent of perfect pitch is. So for some people, certain things come easily and other things are more difficult. And I do think that there are consequences. Anytime, essentially, magic is hacking reality. You're changing reality. And I have a lot of fun in Blood Engines, especially with various theories about how magic works. People have sort of differing ideas. I mean, there's a crazy zealot who thinks that the Aztec mythological system is absolutely true, so he thinks that that's where magic comes from, you know, that there are gods and there are powers, and you can do stuff. There's another guy who's a technomancer who believes that we are, in fact, all running in a giant computer simulation, a la The Matrix, and that the reason he can do magic is because he's figured out how to hack the system a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to leave it open. Maybe he's right. It's possible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as possible as anything else. And magic's also just, it's more interesting and more fun when there are consequences. It's not even always, you know, if you use a magic spell, you're going to be exhausted the next day, although there's some of that. Or if you try and, you know, blunt force control somebody's mind, it's going to give you a really killer migraine, although I do that too. Sometimes it's just unintended consequences.
Right.
You know, you can do something and it'll have really strange reactions. And there's also karmic stuff. If you do too many nasty things will sort of accrue and start happening to you.
Right.
Reality wants to balance the books.
And you can't always control, you know, you can't always fix everything that you break.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you try to fix a problem you've caused with magic by using more magic, you know, it's it can be dangerous. It's like if you got too many toads, you release some mongoose to go kill all your toads. Oh, well, then you're overrun by mongoose.
Right.
You have to send in something. What kills mongoose? I don't know.
Wolves, yeah. Maybe?
Yeah, wolves.
I'm guessing. But...
yeah. Not cobras.
So, one of the things about, so we, here at Strange Horizons, we're very familiar with you as a short fiction author.
Yep.
And your short fiction and also your previous novel were published under the name Tim Pratt.
Yep.
And here's the part where I ask you about the fact that the Marla Mason books are coming out under the name T.A. Pratt.
That's true.
Is it supposed to be a secret that you're Tim Pratt?
If it were a secret, you know, I wouldn't mention it on my blog, and I probably
right.
wouldn't have, you know, I'd be a little upset that my Wikipedia page got updated to reflect that I'm also Tim Pratt. What my publisher...
You do have a separate T.A. Pratt live journal, which I discovered.
I do. I do have a T.A. Pratt live journal that I is in theory for people who want to follow the books. And, okay, so here's the deal. My editor, my publisher, wanted me to use this name because they wanted to create this separate brand for this series, because urban fantasy is, I'm told, a hot subgenre. There are, you know, New York Times bestsellers who are writing this stuff. I myself was just writing the same kind of crap I always write, and then, much to my surprise, my editor and agent were delighted because I'd accidentally written something that is potentially somewhat commercial, at least more commercial than my first novel, which was about coffee houses and stuff like that. So they wanted to give me a different name to create sort of a new brand, and you know, when marketing stuff comes along, I just kind of smile and nod and say whatever you guys think is best, because it's not my bailiwick. I don't really get it. So the way they explained it to me is that the vast majority of urban fantasy readers are not science fiction fantasy fans. Hearing that there's this guy, Tim Pratt, who also writes science fiction and fantasy would be meaningless and uninteresting to them. But they want the people who like my short fiction and my other novel to follow me to these new books. So what we have is sort of a semi-permeable barrier of information is what they wanted. They want the people who know me as Tim Pratt to know that T.A. Pratt exists, right? They want me to tell the world that, hey, all you people who love Tim Pratt, come on over to T.A. Pratt. The T.A. Pratt people, it's okay if they don't necessarily know that Tim Pratt also exists. They're not science fiction fantasy readers. The rationale seems to be that maybe they even have some disdain for science fiction and fantasy. You know, maybe they would be like, oh, you write science fiction. Well, I don't really want to read that. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to essentially launch me as if I were a new writer. So it's kind of like halfway secret, you know, talking to okay. you when people interview me who are, you know, going to talk about the Hugo Award and talk about my career in science fiction. You know, I, of course, just talk about everything. If people who have never contacted me before want to interview me and talk about, you know, T.A. Pratt and stuff like that, yeah, you know, I don't really mention the Tim Pratt stuff.
Okay.
So
Which is fair.
It's wily and sneaky and stuff. I suppose, but you know, I would feel maybe bad about it, but like the most cursory Google search will tell you, you know. So I kind of feel like any attempt to actually make it a secret is kind of doomed from the start. But you know, whatever. I just want people to read the books. They wanted to give me a gender-neutral name because most of the people who write these books are women. Jim Butcher is the big exception, and he writes a book with a male protagonist, or a series right. with a male protagonist, whereas, you know, mostly it's women writing books with female protagonists. So, you know, if they think I'm Mrs. Pratt, that's fine.
If they like the book, that's fine.
That's right. You know, they don't want casual browsers who are used to reading these books by women to be turned off because there's a dude's name on it.
Right.
You know,
right.
And whether that actually happens or not, I have no idea. They were concerned about it, and I said, yeah, that's fine. If they really wanted to make it a secret, they should have changed my name to, you know, Roxy DeVille or something. But
right. No, and I think it's a good choice on your part to, you know, let the marketing people handle the marketing. And
yeah, I mean, you know, I'm willing to...
You handle the writing.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff I will fight for, but it's mostly integrity of the work kind of issues. If they think it's better off to make me T.A. Pratt, you know, it's not like I'm in a bad tradition here. You know, Greg Keyes used to be J. Gregory Keyes, and... You know, lots of people change their names when they're... And it is a new series, and it does kind of make sense to brand it separately. And I sort of think of like Charles DeLint, who, when he writes horror novels, writes them in Samuel M. Key. And it's not like it's a secret and he doesn't want anybody to know. It's totally public. It's just so that readers know what to expect. Anything that comes out as by T.A. Pratt is going to be about this character set in this world.
Right.
So I have, you know, some short stories that are coming out that are by T.A. Pratt. But I guess the only danger would be if they actually became really popular. My publisher might want my other books to be T.A. Pratt, and then I perhaps would have to draw the line, because you can't tell me it's about branding and then, you know, want to undo that. So
right.
Then again, there are worse problems one can have than to be that popular. I suppose we can only hope
you get in the situation of everything being so popular that they want to completely.
It would be heartbreaking. It would be terrible.
So it's the sort of straddling of science fiction and fantasy. Again, you're writing, for you, these books and sort of the Marlowe works are in the, to some extent, the tradition of the rest of your writing. It's your right, like you say, you're writing the same stuff you've always written. But then there is this, again, marketing-based connection to urban fantasy, or even possibly tangentially to paranormal romance. You know, you talked about the process of how the marketing people and the publisher are trying to make that bridge, basically. Do you have any sense that it's working? Are you reaching these audiences that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
I think so, and in large part I have to thank actually Kim Harrison, who has her Hollows series is really very popular in this field, and she loved my book. She gave me a blurb, and my editor was very excited because she doesn't blurb a ton of stuff, and she really loves the books. And she brought me onto her big, huge, active mailing list in her forum and introduced me and encouraged people to read my stuff, and we did a giveaway, and I sent out a bunch of extra advanced reading copies to her readers, and, you know, they seem to be digging it. So, and that's sort of the core constituency that we're trying to reach. You know, I do worry if people are, most of these books do have sort of strong romantic elements, which this one really doesn't. Book two does have a love interest, but let's just say it is not a sweet, happily ever after sort of story.
And we're going to pause here briefly. The podcast interview with Tim Pratt will pick up in part two, which, if all went well, you downloaded along with part one. If not, here's your chance. Again, we're continuing our discussion with Tim Pratt in part two of the Strange Horizons podcast. Thank you.